Welcome to the ISB's podcast on the November board meeting on insurance contracts. My name is Joanna Yeo, Technical Manager on the Insurance Contracts Project Team, and with me today is Pat Finnegan, our ISB board member, and also a board member that has a keen interest in insurance. Pat, let's start with something that might not seem insurance-related, but actually is. The board's decision and discussion on financial instruments, IFRS 9, and whether to reopen IFRS 9 for limited improvements.
Thanks, Joanna. This past month's board meeting, the ISB took up a question which has been on the minds of many observers of both the financial instruments project as well as the insurance project, which is whether or not we should reopen IFRS 9 for certain changes which might allow us to bring greater convergence with the FASB in light of the fact that now the FASB has reached some tentative decisions on their model for financial instruments. And secondly, and perhaps more relevant to this discussion, is whether or not we can find a way to deal with a question that has posed a very thorny issue, which is the kind of differences between your measuring assets and liabilities for an insurance company. And the question is whether or not we might propose an alternative means of reflecting the measurement of the insurance contract. Whether or not all of those changes should run through profit and loss, or maybe whether some of those changes might be reflected elsewhere, for example, through other comprehensive income. So the board is going to take a very kind of rifle shot approach to this with a view towards trying to make limited improvements and also in an expeditious time frame. Because we recognize that these decisions will affect both our progress in two very, very major projects.
Yes, and also there is the issue that some jurisdictions have already adopted IFRS 9 or are in the process of adopting it, and it sounded to me like the board was also kept that in the back of their mind, that any potential changes to IFRS 9 would need to be minimized in terms of the disruption it would cause for those constituents.
That's right. We want to be mindful of those countries and companies that have, if not actually begun to use IFRS 9, have certainly undertaken the internal changes, the systems changes, to prepare for the adoption of IFRS 9. And so we want to be mindful of their work that's been already completed.
Okay, so basically, the decision was just to look at targeted or limited improvements in a timely fashion. I understand that the staff members will be bringing back papers very shortly to discuss perhaps the scope issues and what those targeted improvements will be.
That's right, and we hope to tackle those issues over the next several board meetings. It's difficult at this point in time to predict an exact time frame. But one would hope maybe by the end of the first quarter we will have dealt with substantially most of those issues.
Well, especially in light of the board's decision to set the effective date of IFRS 9 for 2015 expeditiously would seem to be.
Right. It's a high priority.
It's a high priority. Okay, thank you. So let's now move on to what the board discussed on the 15th November. The ISB discussed the residual margin, and they had a education session rather than a decision-making session. Why was it only an ISB session, Pat?
Well, we had to re-examine the question of the accounting for the residual margin for a couple of reasons. As you may recall, our exposure draft, which we published in July of 2010, came to the conclusion that a residual margin, which we define as the difference between the present value of all the expected cash inflows and cash outflows in an insurance contract, along with a risk margin, that residual margin, that difference, if you will, would be locked in and run off over some systematic basis over the life of a contract's coverage. The question that caused us to revisit this is the fact that in June of this year, the board changed its tentative position on accounting for the residual margin. And so now this gives rise to questions about if you're going to unlock or adjust the residual margin, how exactly do you do that? And so the board began exploring those questions, just exactly whether you unlock, just wanted to confirm that decision. And if you do, for what types of adjustments? Are they for all adjustments? Or are they just for certain adjustments, for example, favorable and unfavorable changes in estimates, or just changes, for example, in mortality and morbidity for a life insurance contract? So these questions have to be wrestled to the ground, so to speak. If we can do that, then I think we're in a better position then to evaluate how we might deal with other changes in the insurance contract liability.
I mean, as I understand it, the papers were to provide a holistic view of the ISB's past and future decisions on the residual margin, with a view of confirming or modifying the June 2011 decisions.
Well, that's exactly right. And as I said, in the past, we had tentatively decided to retain a locked-in approach. We modified that in June. So, you know, the board continued its discussion around whether to unlock the residual margin. And there were some board members who believed that unlocking the residual margin is a more consistent approach with the decision to eliminate any day one gain. And as well to avoid the potential for recognition of profit in a future period when a contract is in an overall loss position. On the other hand, you have some board members who support the locked-in approach because they believe a residual margin arises because the insurer cannot recognize income before it satisfies any obligations under an insurance contract. But they distinguish the residual margin from those obligations that arise to fulfill the contract. And so they don't believe that the residual margin accounting should be affected by the changes in other cash flows in the contract. So the question also arose, you know, in this context of, you know, if you decide to go down the path of unlocking, as I said, how do you distinguish between which changes in estimates should be used to unlock the residual margin? You know, some board members believe that the residual margin should be adjusted to reflect all changes, as I said, in estimate that affect future profit. But on the other hand, again, you have some board members who favor unlocking for just certain changes. For example, market variables such as inflation and discount rates, or non-market variables such as mortality and morbidity. So these are all challenging questions, and frankly, there's an awful lot of moving parts here because you have to evaluate exactly how does the accounting for the residual margin affect other changes that you might want to remeasure for. For example, changes in the discount rate or unbundling, you know, of an insurance contract.
It sounds to me like it's important to consider the big picture and how all the pieces work together, and also that the boards were mindful of the possible interaction if some of the changes were to go through other comprehensive income.
Well, I think the important phrase you used there is the big picture. Several board members, including myself, I think believe that in order to come to a very comfortable conclusion on how to deal with the residual margin, you have to see how it interacts with other types of recognition and remeasurement principles in the model, and as they affect, as I said, the discount rate, unbundling, and the like. So, and then where do these changes become reflected? Is it through profit and loss, or is it, as you say, through other comprehensive income?
There were also some concerns about the practicality of both unlocking and locking, as I understood it. Some board members believed that unlocking or adjusting the residual margin would lead to more complexity in trying to do the adjustments. And at the same time, we heard that some constituents found that unlocking would actually also be complex in the sense that they would need to go down to a cohort level and keep records at cohort levels in the runoff of the residual margin.
Yes, and this is an area which I think the board could benefit from some further due diligence with respect to representatives in the industry. As you know, we've had an education session dating back to last February on the question of accounting for the residual margin and as well as unbundling as a whole. Mm-hmm. And the question, you know, I think that you've put out rightly so is, you know, which actually results in more complexity, having to track cohorts, if you will, whether they're unlocked or locked. It's a question that I think the staff has differing views on, and some board members have differing views. So I think that's an area where we'll have to do some more due diligence.
Yes, it sounds like quite a little bit more work to do in this area. Now, the ISB discussed this by itself, mainly because in this area it reached a different decision than the FASB. The FASB have a composite or single margin, whereas the ISB has a risk adjustment plus a residual margin. Well, are there any other differences?
With respect to the accounting for the composite margin, a single margin approach as it's sometimes referred to, or the risk residual, which is a dual margin, the key difference there is the fact that in the FASB's model, the composite margin would be locked in. Mm-hmm. So that I guess has its greatest similarity to a locked in residual margin. And in many cases, the accounting, if in fact we were to adopt a locked-in approach, probably wouldn't produce materially different outcomes, because in many insurance contracts, the risk margin is relatively immaterial.
Talking about life contracts here.
Yes, certain life contracts, right? So you know, this is where you know, sometimes you might say there's a distinction without a difference. And I think that that's, again, something that bears further examination and perhaps modeling to see whether or not we can find common ground with the FASB.
Okay. Again, more work in progress. The ISB and the FASB then met jointly on the 16th of November to discuss Paper 9A and Paper 9, the disaggregation of explicit account balances. Basically, the boards had made a tentative decision to unbundle certain explicit account balances using the revenue recognition criteria. Since then, the boards have also decided to include premium information on the face of the statement of financial performance. This paper considered a different way of looking at it. It considered not unbundling in the sense that the entire contract would remain unmeasured under the building block model, but there would be certain or specific presentation requirements, specifically that premiums or the amounts deposited into the deposit account would not be recognized in the profit and loss account, a concern that some board members have had about the interaction between the unbundling decisions and the disaggregation decisions. How do you think the meeting went, Pat?
Well, as usual, you know, the discussions with the FASB on insurance were very lively, and I think there's an awful lot of common ground, but there's an awful lot of open questions as well that I think that the two boards are trying to seek resolution to. I think it bears a minute here just to step back and talk to our listeners about what do we mean by an explicit account balance. By that, the staff has proposed a preliminary or tentative definition that we're talking about a balance that represents the accumulation of a number of monetary transactions between a policyholder and an insurer, and that balance is credited with an explicit return. Mm-hmm. So using that as a kind of a launching a pad for the discussion, the FASB tentatively decided to separate explicit account balances from an insurance contract. That decision was, as I recall, supported by all FASB board members. In contrast, the ISB indicated a preference to measure explicit account balances as part of the overall insurance contract, but to disaggregate that explicit account balance for presentation and disclosure. The ISB board members actually were also posed with the question with whether or not they'd like to explore an approach in which some other deposit components of an insurance contract could be disaggregated. And so the staff is going to look into that. So in terms of, you know, where we are right now, we've indicated a preference for disaggregation and not unbundling the explicit account balances. And as I said, we'll examine whether or not we want to take this beyond what we what we're currently defining as explicit account balances.
It sounded to me like the concern was a concern about the statement of financial performance, that the premiums that are now recognized on the face of the income statement should not contain deposit components in some way.
Well, that's exactly right, and this question goes to the heart of, you know, defining essentially what a premium is, what is revenue for an insurance contract, and what essentially is essentially a pre-funding of the insurance contract liability. And we haven't really dealt with this question in great depth. We haven't really tried to put criteria around the question of what is a premium just yet. But I think all of the discussions that we've been having to date are pointing in that direction, and somehow, even if we don't finalize something in that area, I think it could help us improve and ultimately come down to what we think will be a sound presentation in the statement of comprehensive income.
Something that most insurers recognize the need for is, for most life insurance today, the statement of financial performance varies significantly from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
That's correct, and there is a on the top lines of many insurance companies a combination of various elements that are all labeled, you know, as components of revenue, but as we know, they comprise different things. And so coming to a better definition, disaggregation, identification, if you will, of those elements, I think would greatly enhance someone's understanding of the performance of an insurance company.
Okay, thank you for that. At that same meeting, the both boards received an update of the ISB's insurance working group that was held on the 24th of October, 2011. We have an earlier podcast that provides a summary of what happened at the insurance and working group. Basically, paper 9 that the boards received did provide a detailed high-level summary of the feedback received from the insurance working group. The boards mainly listened and discussed the use of other comprehensive income and also possible simplifications to the premium allocation approach.
That's right, Joanna. That was the two subjects that comprised most of the discussion at the investment or insurance working group meeting. The industry, as we all know, has presented two models before the staff and the board, which we're examining. Many of the components of those two models are very similar. But as I said, until we examine the question of how we're going to account for financial instruments, the question we opened our podcast with, it's difficult to predict an outcome as to how we'll actually deal with then how we might reconcile the changes between assets and liabilities, and whether or not some changes will flow through profit and loss and other changes will flow through other comprehensive income. So the presentations we received were very helpful, and I think they're going to inform and enhance our discussions when we get to the questions dealing with accounting for financial instruments as well as the IFRS 4 implications. As it relates to the question of the premium allocation approach, I think the discussions that we've had with the FASB to date have demonstrated that, again, there's some clear differences in our views of how we might tackle the premium allocation approach, whether or not some of the recommended simplifications could help bring the two boards together. Is unclear just yet, and I think we need to explore that in a little bit more depth. So I guess, you know, our listeners should stay tuned and watch our discussions as it relates to taking up some of the suggestions that were made at the IWG.
The papers and the presentations at the Insurance Working Group are available on our website and can be downloaded. We also have audio files of the actual meetings for the convenience of our listeners who are interested. Now, next steps. The boards will continue discussing insurance at its joint board meeting on the 12th of, in the week commencing the 12th of December 2011. At the same time, the FASB will be holding an education session on participating contracts on the 22nd of November, with a FASB-only board meeting on the 30th of November 2011. Now, the FASB and the ISB had reached different decisions on the accounting for participating contracts, and therefore that is why the FASB are taking a separate session here. So that should be an interesting one, whether, again, the boards could converge to reach a single answer. Thank you very much for listening.